It is Tuesday, May 19th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. President Lee Jae-myung and Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi held talks in South Korea on Tuesday as the two neighbours struggle to ride out the energy crisis. More on that in news briefing. On In Depth, we delve more into the Andong Summit and what it signals for the future of Seoul-Tokyo ties and the challenges still hanging over the relationship. And on Hallyu Highlights, we look at yet another huge week for BTS, new chapters for BoA and NCT's 10, and IU's emotional birthday event with fans. Let's start Korea 24 right now. South Korean President Lee Jae-myung and Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi held their fourth meeting in about 6 months on Tuesday. The two leaders met in the South Korean president's hometown of Andong, where they agreed to boost collaboration in supply chains and energy. Our KBS World Radio News reporter, Bae Ji-yeon, joins us now in the studio to give us the latest on this story and other headlines of the day. Hello, Ji-yeon.
Hello, Alana.
So President Lee Jae-myung and Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi have agreed that peace and stability in the Middle East must be swiftly restored.
Yes, Lee disclosed their conclusion during a joint press statement released after a summit with Takaichi in Andong. On the basis of that shared view, Lee said the two countries will further expand cooperation in supply chains and in liquefied natural gas, while stepping up efforts to share information and strengthen communication channels on crude oil stockpiles and related supply and demand trends.
And Ji-yeon, what else did we hear from the two leaders?
They also reaffirmed the importance of their country's bilateral cooperation and three-way cooperation with the U.S. for peace and stability in the region amid the fast-changing state of international affairs. Takaichi says South Korea-Japan cooperation on supply chains, including those on critical minerals, is important given the recent international situation. Meanwhile, Lee said DNA analysis will soon begin for the remains found in the long-abandoned Chosae coal mine in Japan, where 183 people, including 136 Koreans, were killed in a flooding accident in 1942. He says such development marks a small but meaningful first step in the two countries' efforts to address humanitarian issues first among his historical issues.
Let's turn now to Samsung Electronics. The electronics giant and its largest labor union were continuing marathon negotiations to try and break an impasse over the tech giant's performance-based bonus system and avert a massive strike that's planned to kick off on Thursday. Ji-yeon, tell us about that.
The two sides enter their second day of last-ditch government-mediated talks at the National Labor Relations Commission in Sejong City on Tuesday. Commission Chairman Park Soo-gun, who is overseeing the negotiations, told reporters that labor and management are narrowing some differences and trying to reach a settlement.
And the union has said that it will go ahead with this 18-day strike unless management agrees to set bonuses at 15% of operating product, a 15% of operating profit, abolish the payout cap, and standardize the bonus system, right?
Yes, that's correct. Negotiations were scheduled to end at 7 p.m. but may run later, possibly continuing on Wednesday if both sides agree. Earlier, the government indicated that it might invoke its emergency arbitration powers to block a strike at the chipmaker if the crisis is not resolved, resulting in strong opposition from the Federation of Korean Trade Unions and the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, the nation's two largest umbrella labor unions.
And in related news, the Bank of Korea says a Samsung Electronics strike, should it go ahead, could shave up to 0.5 percentage points off the nation's economic growth this year. Just what kind of losses are we talking about?
In a private report to relevant ministries on the Samsung situation, the central bank estimated that semiconductor production disruptions could cause losses of around 30 trillion won, considering that it takes about 3 weeks to recover after memory chip lines are suspended. Such losses are roughly 19.9 billion U.S. dollars. In February, the BOK projected 2% growth for this year and was expected to raise its forecast in its revised outlook set to be released next week. The company's labor union has planned a general strike involving about 50,000 workers that is set to begin on Thursday and run until June 7th.
Now let's turn to the latest on the attack on South Korean-operated cargo ship, the HMM Namu. I understand that the Iranian Foreign Ministry has stated its position on the matter. Give us the details.
Iran has raised the possibility that the HMM Namu was the target of a false flag operation in the Strait of Hormuz earlier this month. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Esmail Baghai addressed the matter during a briefing on Monday. This is what he said.
این موضوع از ابتدای بروز این حادثه مطرح بود و
This issue has been on the agenda since the beginning of this incident. And we also have stressed that like any other incidents that occurred in the region, we will carry out investigations and all countries should really keep this in mind that some parties in our region would not spare any measures to escalate the situation in this region. False flags should not be underestimated or concluded as only theoretically possible. This is something that has happened many times.
The spokesperson's remarks come after South Korea's Foreign Minister Cho Hyun asked his Iranian counterpart on Sunday to clarify Tehran's position on the incident.
And Ju-yeon, maybe for some of our listeners who are not familiar with that term, what is a false flag?
It's a tactic in which an attack is staged to make another actor appear responsible. The Iranian spokesperson said Tehran, too, has questions about which actor in the region was behind the attack on the South Korean cargo ship. After inspecting the vessel, South Korean investigators concluded the HMM Namu was struck by two aerial objects, but they have yet to conclude who was behind the attack. Remnants of what many suspect were the engines of the weapons that hit the vessel were brought to South Korea for lab analysis earlier this week.
Shifting gears now to North Korea. A delegation from the reclusive state has toured a drone operator training facility in Russia's far eastern Amur region. Tell us more about that.
Citing local authorities Monday, the Seoul-based publication NK News said the group from South Pyongyang province visited the Center for Drone Competencies in Belogorsk on Friday. There, the group received a briefing on drone development and uses for drones in the military and agriculture. Established in 2023, the center reportedly trains Russian forces fighting in the war against Ukraine. Take note that Ukraine previously alleged that Russia helped North Korea set up production facilities for Kerhan drones, Russia's version of Iran's Shahed drones, and train North Korean drone operators.
Let's get some economic news now. A new report shows that many South Koreans are feeling the economic impact of the prolonged war in the Middle East and have reduced non-essential spending due to rising prices. So, Ji-yeon, what are South Koreans cutting back on?
That would be eating out and driving. That's according to a survey conducted on 1,000 adults aged between 20 and 69 last month by the Korea Press Foundation's Media Research Center on people's perceptions of the economic situation amid the war. The survey found that 77.8% said they were exposed to information about the war and experienced anxiety as a result. When asked what caused their anxiety, nearly 97% cited concerns about rising prices, including oil prices, and some 94% cited an intensifying economic recession. As a result, 43.6% said they were eating out less, 43.2% said they were traveling less, and 41.2% said they were driving less.
And that's where we'll wrap up today's news briefing. Thanks so much, Ji-yeon, for bringing us all the headlines.
Thanks, Alana.
President Lee Jae-myung and Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi held a summit Tuesday in Andong, continuing the two countries' revived shuttle diplomacy after Lee's earlier visit to Takaichi's hometown in Nara. In a joint statement, the leaders said instability in supply chains and energy markets caused by the Middle East conflict has made closer cooperation more important. They also reaffirmed the importance of South Korea-Japan and South Korea-US-Japan ties, while Lee stressed the need for Seoul, Tokyo and Beijing to pursue regional stability through mutual respect and cooperation. For their third bilateral summit, Lee presented Takaichi with gifts symbolizing friendship, including traditional masks, red ginseng and a handbag made with Korean paper. To break down what happens, what it means and what was left unsaid, we're joined today on the line by two guests. First, we have Tokyo-based journalist William Pesek. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Pesek.
My pleasure to be here.
And Professor Kim So-young of the Nagoya University of Commerce and Business. Great to have you back with us, Professor Kim.
Thanks for having me.
Right, Professor Kim, let's start with today's agenda. What did you make of the summit between Lee and Takaichi?
So the summit shows their continued effort for pragmatic cooperation and personal commitment to shuttle diplomacy to normalize communications. And although there weren't any major breakthroughs, they focused on stabilizing the relationship and to expand functional areas of cooperation, especially in economic security and supply chains, which is being acutely affected by the crisis in the Middle East. And this is based on a mutual recognition that strategic coordination is a necessity rather than an option given the dizzying array of geopolitical turbulence.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Pesek, what stood out to you the most from today's summit?
Well, I guess in some ways that it happened at all, right? I mean, that's a positive step. And I think President Lee's comment, he said basically, quote, it's more important than ever for friendly countries to cooperate and communicate, unquote. And I think that's exactly the most important headline from the summit, the idea that two of Asia's most important economies are at this very tense and uncertain and disorienting moment, if you will, joining hands in a way that some leaders in Tokyo and Seoul might not have done in the past. And I think the most interesting question will be, where do we go from here, right? Because Prime Minister Takaichi here in Japan has not been the most, shall we say, welcoming when it comes to ties with China, certainly, but also with South Korea. Perhaps we'll see a pivot in a different direction. And I think that's the most important question is where to now?
Mm-hmm. So to reiterate, no major breakthroughs per se, but definitely seems like a step in the right direction in terms of strengthening relations between Seoul and Tokyo. And when President Lee actually took office, there was quite a lot of widespread anxiety that bilateral relations were potentially headed for quite a major downturn. He has actually been taking a two-track approach with Japan, trying to separate those unresolved historical grievances from more practical cooperation. Professor Kim, do you think that those concerns have since largely eased?
I think the historical grievances are still there. I do agree with what Mr. Pesek just said, that the summit happening at all, and these two leaders who... before they took office, had a lot of concerns about meeting each other and about their attitudes towards each other, have been meeting so often is a very good sign. And both Lee and Takaichi have pleasantly surprised us with their great restraint in ensuring that historical grievances don't surface. But these issues are being set aside, not settled. And I think what they have given us instead is some level of confidence or expectation in their ability to manage these issues if and when they should arise.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, they are both thought of as populist leaders in some sense. So the real test will come when controversy inevitably emerges again.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Pesek, how would you evaluate the trajectory of South Korea-Japan relations during the Lee Takaichi tenure so far and leading up to this point? And how important is their so-called hometown and shuttle diplomacy?
So I agree with everything that Professor Kim just said. I do think this is interesting that, of course, this is their fourth meeting in roughly 6 months. And I think that the hometown angle is a nice one. You know, I think it makes sense. It's the first time that we've seen that between South Korea and Japan. And, you know, President Lee earlier in the year visited Nara, Takaichi's hometown, Japan's ancient Japanese capital. So in some ways, that's a very spiritual place for the Japanese people. That's a step in the right direction. I think what's interesting about this moment is that current events are in some ways having Japan and South Korea taking a deep breath and focusing more on the future than thinking about the past. And what I mean is Donald Trump. And I think basically Trump's trip to China in recent days, I think, has been a real eye-opener for officials in North Asia, because you do see that Trump is desperate for a trade deal, right? He has this war going on in Iran. His approval ratings are weak. His economy is slowing. The only way that Trump can convince his base back home that the trade war was worth it is with a massive grand bargain trade deal with China. That is a trade deal that will leave Japan and South Korea in some ways on the outside looking in. Trump's also made it very clear that he's willing to kind of trade Taiwan for a trade deal with China. He didn't say that explicitly, but that seems to be the subtext for me written between the lines in bold font. So I think the question is where we go from here, and the fact that South Korea and Japan are talking about the future to me is a moment for optimism.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps Seoul and Tokyo are coming together in this moment of, as we've mentioned, much broader geopolitical instability. But I think from Seoul's perspective, you know, there are still highly sensitive security developments going on in Japan, such as its push for constitutional amendment and the potential for sending troops abroad under collective self-defense. Professor Kim, what are some of the remaining risk factors between the two neighbors?
As you said, Alana, I think it's Koreans' perspective and perception that shapes their response. I think in my study of Japan's security policy, I don't find any hard evidence of a return to the kind of pre-war militarism that people are anxious about, because militarization is different from militarism. And there's nothing in the legal and technological capacities that Japan is pursuing that Korean cannot do. But it's the persistent historical memory that's at risk of being politicized. And another risk is divergent threat perceptions regarding North Korea and China. Korea and Japan are looking at a similar direction, but from different positions. And that can become an important turning point on issues such as the potential Taiwan contingency. So, for example, in the January summit joint press briefing, Takaichi made no mention of China in her opening statement, while Lee, in the briefing just now, reportedly emphasized Korea-China-Japan trilateral cooperation for peace and stability.
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk a little bit more about the historical wounds, because Professor Kim, as you mentioned, it is likely just an issue of when they will be brought to the table, not if. Mr. Pesek, on Japan's side, do you think that there is a genuine willingness to address these unresolved historical wounds in the future? Or does Japan view these issues as already legally settled and prefer to leave them, or to try to leave them, out of future summit agendas entirely?
I think it's actually more the latter. And I think that Prime Minister Takaichi, I think she's been pretty clear that she wants the world to move on. And I think that she's very focused on constitutional revision, as you mentioned. And that's something that will not go down very well in South Korea, will not go down very well in China. But her Liberal Democratic Party and her mentor, Shinzo Abe, this is kind of the holy grail for their party. This is what they want to do. And I think in some ways, Takaichi sees this moment as an ideal moment to push forward with this issue, because Japan's realizing that the U.S. is no longer the reliable actor it had been, right? I mean, there's a lot of concerns about Trump in a moment of anger pulling troops out of Japan, perhaps even South Korea. We've already seen the deployment of bad missiles out of North Asia into the Persian Gulf. Trump just doesn't seem to care that much about South Korea and Japan, and that's very worrisome. And I think that for Takaichi here in Japan, she sees this as her moment to get constitutional revision done, and then she'll certainly have put herself in the history books in a very big way. And I think the problem with that, aside from the obvious tensions in Asia, is she's focusing on that and not on the economy, which needs to be her main focus right now.
Mm-hmm. Let's now, of course, turn to the North Korea question. President Lee Jae-myung has championed engagement and dialogue with North Korea. Of course, we've heard quite the opposite from North Korea in recent years. It has declared that South Korea an enemy state and that it has no interest in any kind of dialogue. Takaichi represents a more hawkish stance against the North, but she has also expressed willingness to perhaps hold talks with leader Kim Jong-un. Professor Kim, could there potentially be an overlap in the two leaders' approach to North Korea?
There is definitely overlap in that they're both open to cautious and conditional dialogue and preventing military escalation and instability on the Korean Peninsula. But Lee's objective is to reduce tensions and reopen regular channels of engagement, while Takaichi prioritizes deterrence. And she's also constrained by the abduction issue, which the Liberal Democratic Party has made a political mission and a national duty. Another thing is that, of course, North Korea issue is always high up on the priority. But for right now, as Mr. Pesek said, this summit and all of these different issues comes on the heels of Japan's deteriorating relationship with China. So North Korea isn't that high up on Takaichi's agenda, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the topic of priorities, Mr. Pesek, how high up is South Korea-Japan relations on Japan's foreign policy agenda?
Well, not as high as I would like, frankly. I think it should be higher. I really am not quite sure that Prime Minister Takaichi at the moment has the bandwidth to be essentially focusing on peer-to-peer diplomatic relations in North Asia. She seems to be very, very focused on Japan, certainly China, and on the U.S. And I think her big challenge right now, of course, is Trump, right? Trump is so incredibly mercurial in terms of you never know what he's going to do or say. And I think that she also realizes that she has a very, very difficult balancing act with trying to keep Trump, you know, sort of, you know, in her, sustain Trump's good graces without upsetting him, but also not upsetting her party. I mean, her mentor, Abe, I think in many ways, in the waning days of his premiership, I think a lot of people in Japan were very upset about how close he was to Trump. And I think she's trying to balance a very difficult balancing act there. And I'm not sure that relations with, say, South Korea or even Taiwan are on the top of her priorities list. They should be, but I don't really hear it here in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm. Let's expand a bit more on that balancing act, because as you've just touched on, today's meeting takes place amid uncertainty surrounding U.S. foreign policy, worsening China-Japan relations. Professor Kim, what kind of strategic partnership do you think that South Korea and Japan can forge under these circumstances?
I think they're both favorable conditions for the Korea-Japan relationship. The uncertainty of U.S. leadership and deterrence creates stronger incentives for these regional partners to coordinate. And the worsening Sino-Japan relations has pushed Japan to seek a friend, a diplomatic counterpart in Korea, which is the backdrop, I think, for this particular summit as well, happening right after Trump's meeting with Xi. Japan doesn't want to become strategically isolated or blindsided by a mix-and-shock type of event. And even just recently, China once again demanded that Japan retract Takaichi's earlier remarks about Taiwan. So I think the Korea-Japan partnership will focus on issues they can functionally cooperate on, such as economic security, maritime safety and security, and technology, and information and perhaps intelligence sharing, while sidestepping historical reconciliation.
We heard President Yi mention today the need to improve the relation between Korea, Japan and China. Mr. Pesek, what do you foresee in this regard?
Well, yeah, first, I wanted to say something about Japan and South Korea, if that's okay. I think the focus at this point really should be on economic cooperation, right? I mean, we need to see more activity in the forex swaps area, the foreign exchange swap area. We need to see more cooperation between the Bank of Japan and the Bank of Korea at a moment when bond markets are so shaky. We need more cooperation on energy, supply chains, but also AI, right? I mean, I think in many ways, when you look at how the KOSPI index is heading to the moon right now, I think Japan wants some of that AI magic. And you know, the Nikkei is benefiting from that to some extent. But Korea really has become an incredible standout on the AI front, Japan less so. Japan wants to get some of that magic on board. I think when it comes to Japan, South Korea, and China, though, again, I hate to harp back on Donald Trump, but I think he really is the missing link in this conversation, because a lot of it has to do with what he'll do with a trade deal with China. And I think that he's so focused on having some kind of grand bargain trade deal with Xi Jinping that is willing to throw the rest of Asia under the bus to get one. And I think that's got to be a big concern for Japan and South Korea as the year progresses.
Well, finally, Professor Kim, what do you hope Takaichi's visit will achieve?
Well, I guess I hope that the visits will achieve continuing visits, that these visits will become a regular one and will become normalized so that we aren't surprised anymore that they're meeting so often. And that there is an incremental progress to making standardized and institutionalized agreements in the areas that Mr. Pesek has mentioned, especially in the areas of technology and economic security and supply chain management.
And Mr. Pesek, you've already touched on the importance of cooperation. But before we wrap up, what do you hope Takaichi's visit will achieve?
Well, I think, you know, I'd agree with Professor Kim. I think that if we can make this a more regular exchange, if you will, where the Prime Minister and the President, they meet on an even increasing number of times, that would be great. I think we'd love to see discussion also on creating something of a East Asian Trans-Pacific Partnership, if you will, right? I mean, I think what you need to have is more cooperation between the top economies in Asia, and South Korea and Japan are the leaders when it comes to creating a bulwark against China in terms of its trade policies. And so I'd like to see more cooperation on that front, because that's an area where you will see Japan and South Korea cooperating very happily, as opposed to other areas.
Well, that's all we have time for today. My thanks to Tokyo-based journalist William Pesek. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Pesek.
Thank you.
And Professor Kim So-young of Nagoya University of Commerce and Business. Always great to have you with us, Professor.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index plunged 244.38 points, or 3.25%, on Tuesday to close at 7,271.66. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 26.73 points, or 2.41%, to close at 1,084.36. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Elena.
Okay, Daniel, what is our first story today?
Starbucks Korea is under fire for a controversial marketing campaign that evoked painful memories of a brutal military crackdown on pro-democracy protesters in 1980, especially with Monday marking the anniversary of the May 18 Gwangju Democratic Uprising.
So break down this campaign for us, and exactly, you know, what were the elements that triggered such a strong reaction from people?
So it started with a Tumblr discount event that the coffee chain launched on Friday. The promotion was branded Tank Day, and critics say the name and how it was branded evoked memories of the military vehicles deployed by former President Chun Doo-hwan to suppress pro-democracy protesters in Gwangju in 1980. The campaign also featured the phrase 책상에 탁, roughly translated as a sharp bang on the desk, tak being a Korean sound word for tapping or banging. For many, the word tak conjured memories of the 1987 tortured death of student activist Park Jong, a catalyst for the nationwide democracy movement. At the time, the police claimed the student had collapsed and died after an interrogator merely struck the desk, making a tuck sound, when in fact he had been tortured to death. Park's death was widely reported under the headline, "Tuck 치니 억하고 죽었다," meaning roughly, struck the desk and he died with a gasp, the initial police cover story.
So Daniel, what has been the response of the public and related officials?
Well, the backlash was swift and fierce. President Lee Jae-myung took to social media platform X, calling the campaign inhumane behavior by lowly profiteers that undermined Korea's core values of human rights and democracy. He demanded appropriate moral, administrative, legal, and political accountability. Chung Yong-jin, chairman of Shinsegae Group, which licenses and operates Starbucks Korea, issued a public apology. In a statement on Tuesday, Chung said the promotional event caused deep pain to the victims of the May 18 Gwangju democratization movement, as well as for their families and the public, calling it an inappropriate marketing campaign that should never have happened.
So aside from acknowledging their errors, obviously they had that apology was issued. Did Starbucks Korea take any further action to try and take responsibility for this issue?
Well, Starbucks Korea CEO Son Jung-hyun was dismissed. The executive who planned and oversaw the campaign also removed. Disciplinary procedures were launched against all employees involved. Shinsegae chair Chung personally ordered the strongest action possible, reportedly furious that the incident occurred on the anniversary itself. A senior Shinsegae vice president also traveled to Gwangju on Tuesday to offer personal apology to May 18 organizations, but was turned away. The group said he had arrived unannounced and without a prior appointment and refused to accept the apology. The vice president said he would return once a full investigation is complete.
So were these measures and these gestures sufficient enough to win back any consumers and, of course, public trust?
Not at all. If anything, it's growing. A boycott movement is rapidly spreading online, with consumers posting videos of smashing or discarding products of the coffee chain. Many consumers are saying the combination of Tank Day and the tuck phrase and the fact that it all happened on May 18th is simply just too specific to be dismissed as coincidence.
Well, it's quite a huge reaction, but as you said, you know, given the timing and, of course, the historical references people are seeing in the campaign, it is easy to understand why emotions are running so high for so many people. Let's move on to our next story now.
Hyundai Motor Group's subsidiary Boston Dynamics demonstrated a huge upgrade to Atlas. A new clip shows the humanoid robot lifting and transporting a fridge flawlessly.
Okay, Daniel, give us more details. You know, how big was this fridge?
Well, at around 23 kilograms. It's more of a small minibar type refrigerator. But they also reportedly handle a 40 kilogram one, fully filled also. The video released by Boston Dynamics via its official YouTube channel on Monday local time shows Atlas bending its knees to lift the refrigerator, move to a table in the back while maintaining its balance, rotates only its upper body without turning its entire body to set the fridge down.
What is the significance of this demonstration? I mean, I feel like I could lift a 23-kilogram fridge, but is this a huge step up compared to the agility displayed previously?
Yeah, doing backflips and parkour is great for visual entertainment, but the latest freezer lift and transport shows Atlas can shift its role from a stunt performer to a working robot. It demonstrates overcoming the key challenges humanoid robots must overcome to be qualified enough to start work at industrial sites. Objects in factories or logistics sites are not always placed in a fixed shape or weight. So workers feel the center of gravity of an object with their bodies, change their posture, and use not only their arms but also their waist and legs to balance. Atlas is able to do just that through reinforcement learning-based training. Before lifting the actual refrigerator, Atlas repeatedly learned various weight, position, and friction conditions in virtual environment. It was trained to even overcome small factors that can make tasks unexpectedly challenging. Like they say, it's not the mountain to climb, but the pebble in your shoe that'll get you. So it will take into account compensating factors like floor slipperiness, sensor errors, joint reaction speed, and weight shifts inside the object to carry. Back in January, Hyundai Motor Group announced a plan to deploy Atlas to manufacturing sites by the year 2028.
So does this essentially mean that Atlas is ready to replace human workers? And tell us a bit more about, you know, other robot companies. Have we seen them releasing these kind of noteworthy advancements?
Well, you know, competitors are looming and watching and learning and trying to one-up the other. Hyundai and Boston Dynamics are not the only ones eagerly bragging such advancements. Figure AI, a U.S. humanoid robotics company, live streamed on YouTube on Sunday local time a 10-hour clip matching its Figure 03 robot, rather, against a human intern in a parcel sorting task. The human narrowly won with over 12,900 packages to around 12,700 handled by the robot. The lead swung back and forth, and the human took the lead at first, but fatigue set in. Plus, he had to take brief breaks for water, restroom visits, and a meal. Some viewers commented that if there had been more time, the robot might have won.
So these robots can just keep going and going and going. But what about power? Don't they need, you know, a long time to recharge?
So there are more than one units ready to work. So when one robot leaves its station to charge, the other one steps in to ensure there is no disruption to the workflow. As of 4 p.m. on May 18th, the Figaro 3 units have been working nonstop for 110 hours, processing more than 130,000 parcels.
It's certainly a fascinating development, maybe a little bit unsettling. Let's turn the spotlight now to our final story for today.
We have the final roster of star pro gamers that will represent South Korea in this year's Asian Games.
And I'm assuming that some of those names that made the cut won't come as much of a surprise to anyone.
The Korea Esports Association unveiled on Monday the roster for the upcoming Aichi Nagoya Asian Games in Japan. All eyes will be on T1's star player Faker, who is set to compete in the League of Legends or LOL category again. He will be joined by carrier from T1, Zeus and Gumayushi of Hanwha Life Esports, and Canyon from Gen G.
And Daniel, how many categories will there be for this Asian Games, and how many of them will have Korean gamers competing in them?
There will be a total of 11 categories featured. South Korean teams are scheduled to compete in 9 different categories, including PUBG Mobile, a popular multiplayer battle royale game, and Gran Turismo 7, a simulation racing game.
And going back to the star among stars, donning the Taegu patch to compete, what are Faker's Asian Games accomplishments so far?
Faker displayed dominance in his last Asian Games appearance in Hangzhou back in 2023. And if he defends his crown in September, some would say it's a matter of when, not how. He will be hauling in back-to-back Asian Games gold medal.
Well, that's all we have time for on today's edition of Korea Trending. Thanks so much, Daniel, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's It's that time again, Hallyu Highlights, your weekly scoop on everything hot in Korean entertainment, from the latest K-pop hits to the K-dramas that everyone's binging. And as usual, we're joined today by our resident K-culture expert in the studio, Bernie Cho. Great to have you with us.
Live and in the flesh.
In the flesh. Well, we've been talking about BTS, what feels like for weeks now after that big comeback concert. Somehow, there's still more to discuss. The first ever FIFA World Cup final halftime show has been announced, with Madonna, Shakira and BTS set to co-headline on July 19th at MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. Now, Bernie, we did cover this news on our Korea Trending last week, but can you tell us, explain to our listeners exactly why this is, you know, such a big deal?
Well, for starters, it's the first time ever that the World Cup has decided to do a halftime show. As you know, in the United States, we cannot call the World Cup a football tourney because there's football in the U.S. And ironically, they don't really use their feet. It's American football. But the Super Bowl halftime show is very much a pop culture moment, although it's an American sporting event. I should say maybe an American sporting extravaganza. It is seen around the world globally. It's not just a big deal. It is a massive deal. And so given the fact that the World Cup is going to be staged in the home of a different kind of football, why not lift one of the best practices to be relevant, not just regionally, globally, locally, all three boxes check. And so hence the reason why I think that FIFA, to their credit, took some notes and said, you know what, this halftime show thing is kind of a big deal. Let's go for it. Mm-hmm. But instead of having one headliner, you have three. And each of them have extraordinary reasons for being selected. Number one is Madonna, icon, mic drop, boom. You know, she crushed it, killed it at Coachella. And you figured, you know, she's going to ride off to the sunset. But no. This summer, it just turns out, right around the time of this particular show, she's going to be dropping a new album. Mm. And what better way to promote a new album than on one of, if not the biggest stage in the world at the moment, the World Cup. Shakira, she is a fan favorite. She's been very closely associated with the World Cup around the world. I don't know if it gave her points by the fact that her previous ex-husband was an ex-footballer. But regardless, she's extremely popular, not just in Latin America, in North America, but also in the Middle East and in Europe. So she makes sense. BTS, they're having a moment right now, their world tour momentum. And, you know, it looked like a packed schedule, but it turns out they're available. Wow. They're free. And I think it helps that this particular lineup was curated by one of their old friends, Chris Martin of Coldplay. So if they had an inside, all more power to them. But it's a phenomenal lineup, covers all the bases, and what a great way for K-pop with Lisa for the opening ceremony and BTS for the closing ceremony, halftime show, to really kick things off. And so, again, this was news that, frankly, no one saw coming.
Right.
And, I mean, it is a big deal, and it's got a lot of people excited. But I'm gonna put it out there. I want them to play one of, I think, the best songs on their album, Faya, because I think it is a perfect sports anthem. And for whatever reason, it's not getting love in a lot of places, but apparently it's getting a lot of airplay at a lot of pro sports events. I've heard it's on heavy rotation at some Major League Baseball games, and hopefully it'll carry over. But I think that's a great song.
Okay.
And hopefully we can see the best of what they're doing. And mind you, you cannot get tickets for this.
Mm.
So if anyone's trying, good luck. It's not going to happen. But that being said, a lot of money and, more importantly, awareness is going to be raised for the FIFA Global Citizen Education Fund. So all around, great lineup for a good cause on a what's otherwise going to be a very spectacular event.
Mm-hmm. And BTS, they're not stopping there. Alongside their four sold-out Las Vegas shows on May 23rd, 24th, 27th and 28th, the group is also launching Global The City 2.0. This is a citywide takeover, bringing BTS-themed visuals and events to the desert. Now, Bernie, what's new this time compared to their 2022 Las Vegas takeover, which I actually got to go and cover myself, and I thought it was amazing. So I want to hear what's new, and do I need to go back?
Well, I think you might get a permission slip to go, but the big difference is colors. Everyone knows that BTS, Borahe, Purple, they're synonymous with purple. But for this particular album, they decided to shift gears and go red. So number one, Las Vegas is going to get lit, literally and figuratively, just across the nightlife, nightscape, skyscrapers, whatever. It's going to be red. And it's going to be sort of similar to what happened when they did their show in Seoul, where it's not just obviously light shows, but there's going to be a lot of special events, a lot of pop-ups that go along with it. And I think one of the things that a lot of people are looking forward to is, although they won't be playing there because it's hard to say, it's hard to believe to say it, it's too small for them, is the Sphere. They're going to use the outside of the Sphere to do a lot of heavy promotions. What that's going to look like, it's got a lot of people curious, but the Sphere is arguably probably the coolest outdoor billboard in the world. So how they're going to use that is going to be something that myself and others are waiting to see. But yes, look, they're going to be playing a massive stadium over at Allegiant, the home of the LA Raiders, who are, I think, going to be skipping town those weeks. So Sin City is going to be converted into BTS, the city Arirang, Las Vegas. So be on the lookout for it. But yeah, it's going to be a complete takeover of the strip, of the city. And it's going to be lit up red in celebration and anticipation for BTS.
BTS are going to be painting the town red. Well, from BTS to another K-pop heavyweight, BoA is also making headlines. So a teaser for her new single, No Hard Feelings, dropped over the weekend, marking more than just a music comeback. After nearly 25 years with SM Entertainment, it actually signals the start of a new chapter in her career. Bernie, let's talk BoA. What's the name of her new agency and when is the new music coming out?
Well, you know what? I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly because it's got a really unique, funky spelling. It's a capital letter B, the capital letter A, and then small letters B-A-L, Entertainment. Whether it's B-A-PAL Entertainment, which I think it might be because it sounds like be a pal, be a friend, or BAPAL, which sounds a little awkward, but it could grow on you. I'm not really sure, but I think be a pal Entertainment sounds right. And I do stand corrected. So if there's anyone out there that knows the actual pronunciation, hit me up. But, you know, to put it in perspective, 25 years sounds like a long time, but it really feels like a quarter of a century. That's how long she's been around. And as is sort of the new trend, she has set up shop as her own independent one-person agency. And for whatever reason, that seems to be working quite well for a lot of artists. I think it's safe to say that all the ladies of Blackpink, although they perform together under the YG Entertainment umbrella, each and every one of them have their own agency, which has done incredibly well. So hopefully BoA will also be going down that path as well. But, you know, the music video, the teaser is a different look because, you know, she's known for her charismatic, acrobatic dance moves. But this was a more mature, more nuanced, more storytelling version of her. And so for fans out there, they very much are longing to see what this new look, what this new feel, what this new vibe, and obviously what this new video is going to be. And for those of you out there who have calendars and a pen and a pencil and a marker, mark it May 30th, 2026, just around the corner, 5:30 p.m. KST is when the new digital single and the music video, Ain't No Hard Feelings, is going to drop.
So not too long to wait for BoA fans. Sticking with new beginnings, another SM Entertainment star is also making a move. Ten of NCT has launched his own music company. Now, he's going to be still working with SM on NCT and Wavy Group activities. But what does this kind of, you know, split setup mean for an artist like Ten, Bernie? Is this, would you say, a smart move?
Well, you know, again, it seems to be trending that artists who have worked their way up, have done 7 to 10 to, in BoA's case, 25 years at the same company, the ability to not just grow, but grow out of their sort of original origins, I think seems to be just a natural progression for a lot of these artists who aspire to do more. And in this case, when 10 left SM Entertainment Surprisingly, a lot of fans were not upset because it was very well telegraphed that the partying is not permanent. And if anything, it's on very good terms. And I think for both sides, it might end up being great terms. Again, I'm struggling with the names of these new companies. This one's a little bit, is also stylized, but with little letters. And it looks like, it sounds like Element, which I think might be Element, but I don't know. But I-L-L-I-M-N-T is the official name for TEN's new music company. But what makes this particular launch a little special is he's been teasing, not through videos, but actually from sketches and notes, because apparently he came up with the label name and did a lot of the creatives, and apparently even had his hand on the logo design. So for him, this is not only incredibly creative, but very, very, very personal. And so, again, it wasn't that long ago when he parted ways. It was only April 8th when he decided that he was going to go do some solo stuff. But for fans out there, they're heartened to hear that he will continue with SM promoting for NCT and Wavy. And it also begs a question what his fellow bandmate Mark is up to, because he also left kind of sort of around the same time. Again, seemingly on good terms, but we shall wait and see to what his new outfit, his new operation is going to look like. And more importantly, I hope it's not a name I can't pronounce.
Yeah, we've got to brainstorm those names a little bit. Finally, Bernie, before I let you go, I do want to talk about IU. She marked her birthday on May 16th in a really, really personal way. She rented out an entire theatre at CGV Yongsan iPark Mall just to spend her day with fans. Now, what was meant to be a celebration, you know, birthday celebration, birthday party, it took quite an emotional turn. IU actually broke down in tears and she apologised to the crowd. So, of course, natural question, what did she apologise for? What prompted this apology and how did her fans react?
Yeah, no, this one took a lot of people by surprise because, you know, look, IU is obviously one of the most beloved K-pop. Stars is not, you know, nearly enough icons. She's not an idol. She's kind of sort of indie, but very much an icon, not just as a singer and as a songwriter, but also as an actress. And then by default, as a model as well, because she's so popular. Now, true to form, around her birthday, she did another very large donation to a very worthwhile charity. And, you know, that's not just on point, that's on brand for IU. Now, renting a whole movie theater for her fans is something that she can do, because she's that popular. But what things went kind of sort of a little sideways was that this wasn't just a normal birthday party. She did kind of a special screening of her new TV drama at the movie theater. And apparently this drama has been rife with a lot of controversy. And this got brought up, or she's been aware of the critics and the critiques about not just the story and the inaccuracies, but also, and this was a surprise to me, some people have been criticizing her acting. Now, I personally don't think it's her being a bad actress. This script has a lot of problems. The storytelling has a lot of problems. But yet, she decided to, for whatever reason, take responsibility and apologize. But not only that, like bowed and cried. And, you know, obviously that moved her fans. They're there for a reason. They love her. But this took a lot of people by surprise as to she doesn't have to apologize for this. And so, you know, it's got a lot of fans, you know, moved by this. But at the same time, a debate. There are those who feel like, and I think I throw myself in this category, she didn't have to do that. But there are others who are still coming down hard on her. But what can be said is that even though this drama is getting high ratings, it is also courting a lot of controversy. So much so that not only the TV version has been generating a lot of apologies from a lot of people associated with that. Even the script book, which was released, the first edition publisher is apologizing. And I can't even make up. It's true. In order to fix the problems with the inaccuracies, I kid you not, they're giving away stickers so you can put it in the book and change the passages that didn't, for whatever reason, come out correctly. And for those who bought the book, they're sending out PDF versions of it with the corrections, which to me doesn't make a lot of sense. But regardless, IU, she's very much loved, you know, and her fans were incredibly moved. But I think this is a story that is going to be continually unfolding. But IU, if you're out there listening, you don't have to take a bow for this. You can take a bow for many, many, many other things. This one, take a pass.
Well, that's where we're going to wrap up this week's edition of Hallyu Highlights. A big thank you to Bernie Cho for guiding us through the biggest stories and buzz in Korean entertainment. Bernie, always great to have you with us.
Always good to be here.
And that brings us to the end of today's Korea 24. Be sure to join us again tomorrow for more news, analysis and stories from Korea and beyond. I'm Alana Hill. Take care and goodbye.